Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. I'm your host, Aliza Ercan. Today, I'm joined by Othon Alexandrakis, Associate Professor of Anthropology in New York University. We will be talking about his book, Radical Resilience, Athenian Topographies of Precarity and Possibility, recently published by Cornell University Press. So thank you very much, Othon, for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm very happy to be on the podcast.
So I want to begin by telling you how much I enjoyed the book, and I assure you I don't always say this. But, you know, across each page, your personal and ethnographic engagement really comes true to the reader, or at least to me it did. So I'd love to learn more about how your background as an anthropologist and your personal reflections brought you to this book.
Oh, that's very kind of you, first of all, to say. I'm very glad that you enjoyed the book. I put a lot of heart and soul into writing this one, so it's great to hear that you liked it, and I hope your readers listeners enjoy it as well. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit more then about how I came to the book, This is a bit of a longer story than you may be used to hearing, and I'll try to keep it concise. This, of course, started off during my grad school at Rice University. I was a PhD student, I promise this is not, this book is not a rewrite of my dissertation, but it's sort of, those were the roots, right? And at the time, other students at Rice, and we were all talking, other PhD students were talking about what an ethnography might look like, right? And this was a big concern. And this is George Marcus's department, of course, and James Fulbian was my supervisor. We were talking about what an ethnography might be, what demands it may respond to, how we might communicate the stories that we wanted to tell from the field. And so these were the conversations swirling around at the time. And I developed this project to go to Greece and talk to people on the fringes of the political mainstream. It was a really loose plan. And I wanted to talk to anarchists and Roma and undocumented migrants, you know, people sort of outside those main political spaces. So that was the book. And I should say many of the interlocutors I met in the field during my dissertation are in this book. Many of their stories are featured in the chapters. And so when I initially wrote the dissertation, defended, everything's great. I went off to do a postdoc at Princeton at the Hellenic Studies program there. And my plan was to turn the dissertation into a book like so many people. And began that work. But then, as you may know, of course, you do know, you read the book, economic crisis was changing things. And so the dissertation that I wrote, it felt like it didn't really fit reality anymore. Right? It felt like the stories that I were telling had changed, and the lives of the people who I was trying to recount, again, were no longer, you know, what was going on. And so I undertook a rewrite. I revised, and this was going well until 2015, when the refugee crisis hit Greece. And I was close to being done a draft at that point. But then again, because some of my main interlocutors were undocumented migrants and others who work with them, again, these stories had changed. So it struck me that, again, the story that I was trying to tell, the narratives, that it was just the beginning of the story. It wasn't, it felt like it was unfinished, that it was all new. And of course, we never tell finished stories, right? But it was just, it felt like we were in the middle of stuff happening. And so I was rewriting, and the identity of the book changed again and again, from something to do with resistance and struggle to organized action to, you know, bare survival. And then eventually I found my themes, which is hope and possibility. And I began to think again about the book that I was writing, reflecting on how it had evolved, and realized that it was very, you know, ethnography forward. I have this in the introduction. It's about the stories of the people who I spent time there, who were kind enough to allow me into their lives, right? And so I wrote the book to promote connection between those people and readers, to convey sort of the stories that they were telling. And I felt like going back to those conversations with my colleagues at Rice, that this was the right way to write this book, right? I had something to show, that they had something to communicate, and that I was going to help them do that. And so these stories are motivated by this sort of impulse to foster connection and to help people sort of not have a snapshot of somebody's life, but actually spend a little bit of time and see how things played out under these really terrible conditions, in the hopes that they might, you know, resonate with what they may be going through, or maybe they can make more sense of what they're hearing about what these people have endured. So that was the motivation. And I felt that the book, at least I felt satisfied after I had written it, that, you know, the book does do this. At least I hope it does, that these stories do foster some connection.
It really does. And I also really enjoyed how, even when you explain this, you connect both the people, but also the broader context of Greece, right? And how it really shapes everyone's lives. And, you know, as I was reading the book as an urban anthropologist, the role that Athens as a city plays really stood out to me. So I'll ask you to set the stage for our listeners who might not be familiar with the city. What about Athens prompts thinking about radical possibility or hope, as you just mentioned?
Sure. That's a great question. Athens. So we all have our favorite cities, maybe, in the world. Athens is mine, by far and away. I've spent lots of time in Athens. So Athens is one of those places that people feel like they already know, right? That they imagine, people have an imagined sort of Athens in their heads. And it usually has to do with, you know, 3,400 years of history, and these temples and things that are there. But I think the way that the way that I think about Athens, I think about Greece is easternmost, edge of Europe, right? And Michael Hirschfeld's written lots about that sort of position of Greece in the European, in Europe, geographically, but also in the European imagination and things. And so that kind of being on the edge, or being at the edge, I find very interesting. And it it plays out in multiple aspects of the city, of the sort of Athenian identity, if we can sort of generalize an Athenian identity, as being sort of on the edges of Europe. And some people, of course, articulate that as being on the border. Others talk about it in terms of being a threshold, you know. So there's various different ways of talking about that position of Athens. So anyway, and that's, of course, in my mind. Athens It's interesting. It's not a terribly old city by European standards. It became the capital of Greece in 1843, if I'm not wrong. At the time, that was established with the help of European powers. And so they had a big hand in forming Athens as a capital city. So it is part of this sort of European project of making modern Greece. And so it has that sort of colonial history, which is fascinating in Europe. And once established, then we have several waves of migration to the city. We have the Greek refugees from Asia Minor coming in the 20s, World War II, and then we see a huge influx of people, 50s and 60s, coming to Athens to make a better life. It was a city that became the capital and then became quickly populated during these events. And during these periods of time, and of course, during the 90s, this is maybe a little bit lesser known, we start to see lots of migration coming in from other parts of Europe as well. So the 90s is a period where we have another population boom. So presently, there's 3.5 million people living in Athens. That's 35% of the entire population of the country. So that's a lot of people. Athens is a city of neighborhoods, right? So it's all little sort of neighborhoods, each with a unique identity, their own histories. There's lots of, when you walk down Athens, you'd see modern apartment blocks, ancient temples, pedestrian boulevards. There are still walls riddled with bullet holes from the Civil War, right? So there's so much in Athens. It's a place where people travel to looking for a better life, right? It's a place where people built things for themselves. It's a location of art, of industry. It has a port. Anyway, this is all to say that Athens is a very vibrant place with a very sort of unique position in Europe. It has an exciting history, at least I think so. Most recently, it's also been a place where people have been subjected to very intense neoliberal austerity, right? A city has experienced sort of mass sudden impoverishment, where Athenians witnessed, thousands of people in 2015 literally walk through the streets towards a better life. So all of these things have sort of come together and in my mind make it a very interesting place for thinking about possibility, thinking about people sort of trying for or coming there for something better, working towards something, and most recently being pushed beyond their limits, right? Trying to make even just a life worth living in this very vibrant place. So this is a long answer to your question again, I feel that Athens, to me, it's a place that is sort of a prime with possibility. It's an excellent place for thinking about people building things and living with each other, coming through some very interesting histories making a life in this really vibrant city. So that's the Athens I imagine.
Indeed. And I think that's very helpful to sort of populate Athens, which is at the heart of my next question. So, throughout the book, as you know, we meet many Athenians who experience different withdrawals from and intensifications of social life. So how do their stories culminate in a social topography of resilience, in your own words?
That's a very good question. And this is the heart of the book, isn't it?
Yeah. So please summarize the book.
Please summarize the book. Oh, okay. I'll do my best. I think it's a big question. So I'll do my best to just sort of condense things. So here we go. So the book, I just sort of sketched a picture of this big Athens, right? It's not about everyone, right? This book is not about everyone. This book is about those people who have encountered some sort of emergency in their lives, right? Who have sustained some sort of injury, be it from neoliberal austerity, from the refugee crisis, or some other combination. And we should say, that you know the economic situation in Athens has not been great for a long time, right? That problem predates the sovereign debt crisis of 2010. So it's a long time coming, right, this problem. And my interest is in those people who were pushed beyond their limits, right? So individuals who had sustained some sort of injury, be it pension cuts, loss of work, salary cuts, or seeing their social support networks eroded, or having services that are vital to their lives kind of taken away, or whatever it may be, suddenly find themselves completely disoriented and unable to sort of carry on, right? So that's the population that I'm working with. And I get the question that you asked is about social topography of resilience. And in the book, I define that as this kind of aggregate ground of coming through injury, right? This aggregate ground of coming through injury. And so the people who I work with are the ones, or who I've been writing about, are the ones who sustained this injury and are looking to try to come back to a life worth living, right? So I break it down into several sort of phases of this or periods of this. And I should, again, underscore that it's not all, they're not interrelated, they're not linear, they're not sort of directional, as you saw in the book. But these are people I've talked to who found themselves in different sort of stages of trying to get back to a life that they can sort of understand and that they can survive in. So the group sort of goes like this. So first, there's the people who have sustained this injury and things just don't make sense anymore, right? Life isn't the way it should be. Their guarantee to work shouldn't have been taken away. The help that should be there when that happens never materialized. These are people who don't sort of understand why it is the way it is, right? And all the promises were broken, basically, and all the avenues that they had to come back to something were taken away. And so I found that those individuals were sort of pulling back, right? Were disaggregating from this sort of social collective or this the social worlds they inhabited, were sort of becoming isolated. And so these individuals are part of this social topography, right? They're part of that aggregate ground. They sort of pulled away. The next group have to do with the kind of the next stages of this, which is seeking stability, right? Find a stable place for oneself in this sort of strange situation. So finding ways for oneself to kind of survive, right? These are also people now who are doing things in the world, are starting to act to try to figure out what's going on. And after having done so, pull on the threads and accumulate the resources they need to at least stop what's happening, right? And continue on. Eventually, of course, individuals who are successful here find stability and begin to connect with others. I'm going to summarize a little bit. And then working with others, they begin to build these kinds of shared worlds, and finding ways with them creates a forward momentum, right? So they begin to imagine futures with others. So this range that I've sort of described here is kind of that I've sketched from sort of pulling back from the social to seeking stability to finding ways to get back to making a better life for oneself, and then beginning to collaborate with others and working with others to build something. Is this aggregate ground? So the aggregate is made up of all of this. And again, it's not linear. It's not it's not teleological. It doesn't mean, you know, that you're going to make it to the one end or whatever. People backslide. People fall out of all of this. People come into it again and again. And sometimes it's recursive. Sometimes it's cyclical. But this is that aggregate ground that's sort of below the surface of the normative, below the surface of the social mainstream, where people have been sort of knocked out of everyday life and are trying to struggle to get back into it. That's sort of what I imagine as being this social topography. geography, right? This this aggregate ground of people coming through these injuries. And I found that possibility happens, at least this is what I argue, when this aggregate sort of becomes more solidified and more stable and begins to interact with the broader social space of Athens. So these projects that people emerge together, that they pursue, individuals who have been sort of knocked down and now are back together and working on this. And these projects vary, and I won't go into the possibilities that's in the book, but they start to engage with Athens and pull others in and destabilize things in their own way. So the social mainstream, that is. So does that make sense? That's what I'm, yes.
Indeed. And that's okay. Such a wonderful way to sort of disaggregate aggregate ground, so to speak.
I didn't want to present it as a something formed, right, or something uniform. Aggregate, it is made up of all these different experiences and positions and concerns and things, and so they all come together. But what they share is this experience of injury and this condition of being completely confused by what's happening and trying to make sense of it again, one's world being completely upended, right? So.
Indeed. And I think, you know, something that's closely related to aggregate ground is your understanding of resilience as a negative space. And yeah, so I'm very curious about what radical comes to mean when we think of resilience as a negative space.
You know, that's a very good question. Again, that's part B of the book. That's another big one. So negative space of the political. So I've just described this kind of aggregate ground, right? And that's, I argue in the book that this is sort of a pre-political space. Maybe I'll just take a moment to share an aside. I was talking to a mentor, while I was writing this book during my postdoc, Professor Bornman, and we were talking about the political, right? What is the political? What is politics? And this is something that I've been thinking about since my dissertation. And he told me, sort of on a fundamental level, it's a question about, you know, am I all right? Are you all right? Are we okay? You know, whoever we is, right? And then how do we work together? How can we be okay? And this sort of question is sort of at the kernel of the political, isn't it? It's like sort of that seed, that element. And that was really at the heart of my thinking about politics in this book. And so when you think about that aggregate ground that I was describing earlier of somebody being knocked out of the social, basically nothing makes sense anymore. And their friends aren't acting the way that they should. Those resources aren't there. The collective projects don't make sense anymore that they were involved in, whatever they may be. You find people, I found at least, that those people were pulling back. And I describe this pulling back, and I should say, not as an antisocial activity. It's not like somebody just turned their back on the social. That's not what happened. It's as if the social world just was alien suddenly. It didn't make sense anymore. None of this makes sense anymore. And so it was a pulling back in the sense of looking around and trying to figure things out all over again. And so in the book, I describe how this condition, right, allows people to start to see things a bit differently. If the promises were broken, the narratives don't make sense anymore, the expectations aren't materializing, you start to think differently and start to imagine things differently. And in the process, gain this kind of critical perspective. That's at the heart of the radical that I'm trying to communicate, right? This idea that in trying to make sense in the normative being disrupted, our possibility of seeing things differently is expanded, right? It's intensified. And so in this, we have people under this condition of seeing things differently and not being constrained by these kind of normative blinders. And not, this isn't a total affair, right? It's not a complete phenomenon by any stretch. It's some aspect of lives. Begin to do things differently, see things differently, pursue different projects, and then come into critical relation with others, others who are also sort of seeing things and trying things differently because they have to, frankly, right? And emerge projects, small ones, big ones, collective ones, whatever it may be, or rejoin other projects that are ongoing, but then destabilize those. And so we have this new, we have this coming to or back to the political, back to this collective life, having gone through this period of, well, frankly, this period of impoverishment and slaughter and injury, with new response and new ideas and new thoughts. And one of the things that I try to highlight in the book is that, again, this is for a subset of people, right? So, you know, all those collective responses, solidarity projects, resistance actions that we see, anthropologists have been writing about this now for decades, those are still in place, right? Those are all good. But what I was interested in is those other kinds of projects that are emerging from this space of having been disintegrated from that social collective. And those ones look very different from what we're seeing kind of in terms of mainstream politics, be it resistance politics or sort of the more mainstream politics. So that's what I sort of imagined as the negative space, this sort of aggregate ground where people have been sort of knocked out. It's really about these small everyday spaces in these conditions of being in the transnormative, right? Of pre-political intensification, all of this sort of stuff happens in these places. And when people are meeting up and starting to try things together, they bring something potentially, maybe, radical, right? And completely different, untethered from this kind of, from the mainstream back into that political space that they once inhabited, right? So so there you go. That's how I think about the negative space of the political.
For me, as a reader, a key concept to think with you through this landscape of politics was awkwardness. So I'm curious about what awkwardness does for you, especially as you, you know, thought with or as you were relating to interlocutors like Samba, Amalia, or Nefeli's father.
Yeah, excellent question. So awkwardness, yes, there was a lot of awkwardness in the book, wasn't there? And but this was a theme that that came to me, or this was a way I began to think through things. So in the book, I sort of look at four forms of awkwardness that I observed, and I try to. This is a thread that runs through. It wasn't intentional, obviously not. I mean, it all comes from ground, but it was something that it occurred to me in the, I think, 12th edit or whatever it was of the book. And so I pulled it out, and I have a colleague at York who really inspired me to think about it more, Tanya Ahmed. She was no longer at York. She's elsewhere now, but she really helped me think about what was going on there. And so with awkwardness, so I talked about this aggregate ground a little bit earlier. I started to observe these kind of awkward feelings begin to mark sort of a person's coming to see, if not yet understand, right, what was going on, them being pushed out of normative expectations and being pushed beyond the normative limits, right? So it became awkward because one would, look for help or come to expect something and it not happening. And so acting in a way that would that doesn't seem to fit. Nobody understands why they're doing it, right? And they start to feel awkward because they don't understand the rules of the game anymore, right? So that was the first sort of sign of awkwardness. And my interlocutors, Nico especially, would talk about being awkward all the time, you know, having conversations and asking things of people that he felt that he could, but they wouldn't reciprocate or they wouldn't understand what he wanted or they would. Whereas, you know, 3 weeks ago or a month ago or a year ago, this would have all been fine. And so for him, that sort of marked this kind of beginning of a disintegration. And so he would pull back, right? The awkward feeling was motivating in that way. The other sort of awkwardness here is it plays out again in terms of people trying to resolve that awkward feeling. So, it starts to run through a life and it's not comfortable. And so people were trying to seek an end to awkwardness, which actually I interpreted as seeking stability. So it was a resolution. So no more awkward encounters, right? No more demands that wouldn't make sense. No more sort of failed promises. They just wanted some sort of stability in life. And so that I came to read as an end to the awkwardness, because they would talk about it in that way, right? I just can't do this anymore. I don't feel like I belong here anymore. I need to, figure out a way to make a stable life for myself. The next stage, of course, is awkwardness with others. So having made some sort of stability, awkwardness plays out again when you start talking to other people about the world that you've now created for yourself, one that you don't feel is shared, at least not in its entirety, or at least not legible to others necessarily. And so you have to do explaining, and you have to sort of position yourself and tell people, what it is you're after. So this awkwardness here is in the encounter with the other individual. And what I found interesting was that although people had experienced this awkwardness, resolved awkwardness through finding some sort of bare stability for themselves, and now are starting to interact with others, this concern with trying to connect in this now sort of post-awkward state was shared. So other people, and the story about Samba really plays this one out. It was about two people who had come to stability, right, in their own ways, and were trying to now connect with somebody else to try to work together and find ways towards something better, right? And so it was talking about awkwardness that I found very fascinating, and talking about not just what they had been through and how they resolved it in the everyday, but now also talking about how these two post-awkward people in a new awkward situation can start to work towards something better, right? And it is this possibility, that's coming into relation with possibility, and starting to, beyond stabilization, starting to envision something and desire something together, right? And so the awkwardness begins to dissipate in this moment where people are connecting and thinking forward. And of course, the final one is where the awkwardness has dissipated completely. People are connected with others. They have stability in their lives. They may be working on projects that with others, whatever they may be, that will bring about new possibilities. And all of this has consolidated. And even if the project itself it doesn't make perfect sense to others looking in on it, it doesn't matter, because you are with a group of people who sort of share things and see a direction, right? And see a future, whatever that may be. So that's how awkwardness worked for me. And it came up over and again in these different stories. And so I used it to sort of think about critical transitions and different sort of perspectives and new sort of conditions and the work that people were doing, the sort of agentive undertakings that they would pursue to get to something better, right? To work their way through this aggregate ground. So yeah, awkwardness was a really useful device for me in this book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll keep grilling you on awkwardness. So also methodologically, I found it fascinating that you stayed with awkwardness rather than worked against it. So I'm curious about what awkwardness did for you during fieldwork.
Good question. Okay, so it's a very interesting one. So in terms of methodology, think about this one for a second. So I guess there's two parts to my answer, maybe. Yes, I'm going to stick with, okay, there's two parts. So the one has to do with the fieldwork itself, right? So feeling one's way as a researcher and following hunches, right? And I found Yeah, I think this is right. I found that when there was awkward moments, that's when my sort of anthropological senses were triggered. Right, it seemed like this was a moment when somebody was working through something. So I tuned in, right, and stayed with that awkwardness, and tried to spend time with people. So it marked times to me when people were doing something, were trying to work through something. So as a methodological sort of tool, it worked to help me identify these times. And then again, beyond sort of people feeling awkward, it was also, trying to resolve awkwardness between them and on and on and on. So in the field, it marked times when people were trying to figure things out. And so it helped me sort of tune in to those things. The other piece of this is about feeling awkward as a field worker. Right? I think we've all experienced that, right? But it was more than just, asking for that interview and it being canceled. Like I said, I mean, it was long-term relationships with these people. I've known them since my dissertation, which is a long time ago. And suddenly they started acting differently or talking with me in different ways or blowing me off or doing whatever it may be. And these were certainly awkward moments for me. But again, it alerted me to the fact that something was happening, right? Something was shifting. Something was going on. And so instead of pivoting and looking for somebody else to talk to, or thinking, they're going through something, just leave them alone, or explaining it away. Again, that was to me a sign that the field itself was maybe changing. The ground was shifting, right? And so, not everyone, I should be clear about this, not everyone began to respond to me differently, but the ones who did were the ones that I really was interested in. And so it helped me kind of identify my population for this book. It helped me sort of narrow the people I was talking to those people who were, in fact, completely destabilized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, keeping with this thread of methodology, if awkwardness is something that's apparent in the book, something that's maybe a bit subdued, which I think might be important, is your movements across the city. So throughout the book, you take us through hospitals, anarchist spaces, scrapyards, Roma settlements, among other parts. So I'm curious about how these movements helped you link stories of people whose stories may not seem interconnected, but are indeed so.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That is a very good question. So I think everything is connected, right? if we look closely enough, all of the threads, everything is connected. And so when I think about, all the people in this book, and there are a lot of people in this book, the migrant scrappers, they work with the Roma, anarchists sort of work with supporting migrants. Migrants who have a minimal guarantee to medical services in Greece use hospitals, right? And then in my MA thesis, I spent a lot of time talking about Romani encounters with blood services in hospitals. So, we could follow these connections all over the place. These cities are connected, interconnected, and finding these webs is really interesting. But I guess when I was writing the book, I sort of struggled with this tension, right? To present everything as connected, right? That was when I could have presented everything as completely connected, or allow the different worlds to sort of exist side by side, chapter by chapter. And I didn't really know how to resolve that. I spent a long time thinking about whether I should create this really flowing narrative that sort of ran across the city, much like I moved across the city, interview in a hospital one day in a Roma settlement the same afternoon, or allow these worlds to sort of exist side by side. And I guess what I came to was I built in the connections, right? So I think I showed, and you can tell me if I was successful, that there are connections, right? And I do sort of hint at them and provide evidence of them. And in fact, some of my interlocutors talk about them, and in some cases, they're at the heart of their stories. But I tried to set these worlds sort of apart, because that's how people experience their everyday, right? As this kind of social world within the context of Athens. And so the chapters are sort of respect that experience of the city and experience of their social worlds. And of course, as we move on through the book, these worlds become bigger and more connected in different ways. But towards the beginning, they're more, you know, isolated. So it was hard for me to resolve that. And I should say there was another concern for me as I was puzzling through this one. It had to do with the way that Athens has been presented in the past and the way that people imagine Athens. And I wanted to push back against this idea of Athens as a city of, you know, these kind of white Athenians, because I saw that as a remnant of this kind of European colonialism, this sort of dominant imaginary of what Athens is and what Athens was. The history of Athens is much more complicated than that narrative. And so I wanted to give equal page space and narrative to everybody who was there, right? So the Roma, the whose history goes back as far as Greece goes back and further, the undocumented migrants and documented migrants for that matter, people who have invested in a big way in the city, anarchist youth who have been part of the story of Greece since it was a kingdom, and on and on and on. So to me, there was this, this imperative, I guess it's a, sort of following this decolonial interest, right? This interest to present Athens as something other than the modern sort of Athenian picture that we have, that has been cultivated since the modern city was founded, right? So I wanted to push against that. So in presenting these stories, it's interesting, the mobilities, they are connected. And I think the connections, I hope at least, and you know, your listeners can tell me if I achieve this or not, and you can tell me, it shows how they are connected. But again, it respects these individual stories and doesn't necessarily present Athens either as this kind of social total, this whole, right, which it isn't necessarily. It shows that there are these distinct worlds within this place. It shows that they are connected and that it is another kind of aggregate ground in and of itself. But each of these communities, again, deserves their own space, I felt, in the book. So I did try to preserve those worlds kind of chapter by chapter.
I think that absolutely comes through. And you know, speaking of people connected, from the beginning of the book, you're a part of the broader picture that you present. And as I say this, I especially have your family's letters in mind. So, you know, we don't just see you at the moment of fieldwork per se, but your family histories, past, own ghosts that bring you to radical resilience. So I'm curious about your thinking around positionality and maybe the temporal politics around positionality.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Yeah, I'm not sure I can offer a complete answer to this one, but maybe just some thoughts on it. It's a really, really great question. So the stories, right, the letters, I open with the letters in this book, and it was a bit of a difficult decision to do that. I was talking with my editor, fantastic editor, Jim Lance at Cornell, about whether or not to put these in. And I think that, you know, in our conversations, at my conversations with him, I was thinking about, you know, building out the context. He was always pushing me to make it deeper and provide more context and information. And so that helped me come to the decision to include the letters. So these are love letters, for the listeners, they're very deeply personal, not to me, but to people who died a long, long time ago. And I was worried that they're just sort of too far removed from the current ethnographic context to be relevant. And so again, I struggled with keeping them in. Because they do tell a family story that's kind of not directly connected to what was happening in Athens, at least not in a direct way. But as I explained in the introduction, I hope, I opted to include them in the end. And this was for a few reasons. So first, they were on my mind throughout field work. I was trying to figure out, you know, what they meant to the people who wrote those letters, what the letters held. And also, my thinking about the situation of the letter writers shaped the way that I came to understand the idea of resilience that I tried to develop in the book. So the letters were important, right? I mean, they were in the background, but they were there. I guess, so then back to your question, I guess there's two things here. So first, I feel like the letters sort of show that positionality is really deep, right? It matters not only to how we as researchers, we localize in the field, so to speak, but also how we come to see things and critically how to think about things. So I think this is, when we think about positionality, maybe this is something that we talk about often, right? What we bring to the field and how we, and then how we think about how our training shapes how we think about things, how our histories, our lives shape how we think about things. But maybe there's a second thing here as well about the letters. And this is something that I thought about after having written that introduction. It's interesting that, you know, this was something that these letters were written in the past, right? They were stored in the cellar of my grandparents' house, and they came back through me after I sort of found them by accident, right? So the past doesn't really stay in the past. I mean, we already know this, but it comes forward in different ways for different people at different times. I think we know this as well, and it comes entangled with things that are in the present, right? So if we're thinking about positionality, it's not just maybe who we are and how we see and think about the field, but also what we enable to be transmitted, right? And so this is part of positionality as well, maybe. And this is, I'm still working through this, but I'm thinking about this as a field worker. You know, your positionality, it's not just one of, you know, being there and thinking about it, but also what you allow to come and sort of what assemblages that might form around you on purpose or not, by accident as this one was or not. And so what sort of materials, what sort of stories, things may come forward. And so the history there goes way, way back. It may be opaque. I certainly didn't expect the letters to come forward. But anyway, maybe that's my best attempt at an answer to this very good question, a very complicated question about positionality. I'm thinking about, you know, who we are, how we think, but also how what we can bring or what we enable to be transmitted. So there we go. Still thinking about this one.
No, that is so beautiful to think about what we allow to be transmitted. And, you know, I want to speak with you about the images you used, maybe in relation to what you allowed us to see. I mean, to me, these images really made the ineffable a bit more effable while respecting your interlocutor's boundaries. But correct me if I'm wrong or if, you know, the intention was something else. So, yeah, I'm just curious about how you approach the visual aspect of the book.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question. So the pictures were all 100% intentional, right? None of these were random snapshots that I just decided to include in the photo. We don't do that in the book. We don't do that anymore, do we, as anthropologists? But they're not there. They're not intended to be evidence, right? They're not, you know, to show you that this happened. What I hope they do, because again, everything from the framing to the content, even the lighting on some of these photos is intentional. And even the style of the photos is intentional, right? I have that one of the disaggregated Molotov cocktail. I have another one that looks like street photography. All of these are intended to sort of consolidate and communicate sort of the key ideas of those of the chapters that precede them. So they're there to, if you spend time, you know, with the photo, it takes you back to the chapter, and you can trace through the chapter the different sort of themes that are part of that image. And sort of they do this kind of returning, that I hope at least they do this kind of or prompt this kind of returning, because not in every case is it obvious what they're intended to communicate. The wrapped up maps, for example, or the picture of my hand. But in the when taken in consideration of the chapter that precedes it, I hope that they help draw out particular thoughts and ideas, and then maybe also connect with what's about to come. Right. So they kind of provide this opportunity to reflect, and I think that that helps a reader as they move from chapter to chapter. These images kind of prompt a different kind of mental work than sort of reading and remembering, right? This kind of like thinking and thinking back, which I think is very helpful.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me as a reader, besides thinking with you, it also helped me to feel with you. I don't know, it really prompted the kind of emotional work for me.
Yes. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, lastly, I want to ask, what is next for you? What are some new projects or questions that you're interested in currently?
Okay. So I'm still working in Greece, still working in Athens. there's a lot here. So my latest project, I've recently wrapped up a year-long field work on this one, has to do with undocumented child migration to Greece. This was a project that I began after 2015, the start of the so-called refugee crisis in Greece, began to think about all these children that were coming through, and because I was there doing field work when the main sort of group of refugees made their way through the city, and it was just an extraordinary experience. I mean, it was disorienting in a completely different way to see this. And I had a graduate student at the time working in Lesbos, and that was, of course, one of the main points where migrants came to Greece. And so I traveled to Lesbos to see what was going on the ground, and I was completely taken by the situation there, the efforts that were being made by locals to respond, the experiences of migrants sort of walking across fields of olive trees, which had new pathways carved into them by these thousands of people going through. So that sparked my interest in undocumented migration. And then I had the opportunity to work with an NGO that spent energy and resources in supporting children at the Moria refugee camp. And their work was primarily with undocumented migrant children, unaccompanied undocumented migrant children. So that triggered my interest in their stories. And during my field work, I was fortunate enough to spend time at a shelter for one of the shelters in Athens for unaccompanied minors. And I began to think about, political issues and humanitarianism this time, thinking about how these children started to see themselves as part of the world of Athens, as part of Athens? What were these worlds that they were creating for themselves within the shelter, and how did these humanitarian projects shape that? And the efforts of these workers within the space of the shelter to create a safe home for these kids who are experiencing probably the deepest form of precarity and most unsettling form of precarity a human could, right? At least the way that I was seeing it at the time. And so that's the project that I'm currently sort of working on putting together, articles and books coming, thinking through these things. And I was some of the themes that came up for me was about secrets, was about friendships, was about what does childhood resistance look like, thinking about education in a different way, thinking about futures. You know, how do children between the ages of 4 and 12 who are living in the shelter, you know, how do they begin to think about future? And what does that mean, you know, for this population? So that's a project that I'm very focused on now. And one related to this is a collaborative project that is just getting off the ground now. With colleagues at universities across Canada and the US on war-affected children in conditions of protracted displacement. So children who have come through war, not necessarily unaccompanied children, but children and families who are in countries living in these conditions of just sort of liminal existence, right? They can't normalize their political status or their legal status. They are not able to move on in many cases, but they're stuck there. So what does that do to a life, a young life, this condition of liminality, of deep liminality? And so we're theorizing this idea of liminality, and we're looking at this, as I mentioned, across three contexts, Greece, Israel, and in Kenya. So different sort of contexts where this protracted state is realized in different ways. It has different temporalities, different sort of cultural contexts. So a very interesting project just starting to get off the ground. And that's what I'm currently sort of invested in working towards those, articles and books, and looking forward to field work again in Athens. So,
wow, these both sound like really difficult and important work, and we hope to have you and your collaborators back when the books come out.
Fantastic.
So thank you very much, Othon, for joining us and for your insights.
Oh, it was absolutely my pleasure, and thank you for your interest in my book. It was really great to talk to you.
Likewise. I'm your host, Aliza Arıcan. This discussion of Radical Resilience, Athenian Topographies of Precarity and Possibility, published by Cornell University Press in 2022, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.